From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today we explore the long-term socioeconomic effects of the thousands of vacant houses in Milwaukee. Then a local doctor discusses some recent advances in human genome science. Even though it's past Festivus, we present you with a few food-related grievances, including the Kraft cocktail.
They list out 19 ingredients to make the drink, and then the drink name is so effusively opaque that I have no idea what the drink is going to taste like. The whole endeavor just wants me to do a shot and get out of there.
And renowned writer Amy Tan discovers accidental inspiration in a history book.
And I turned the page and I saw 10 beauties of Shanghai, these 10 young women, five of them wearing an outfit identical to the outfit my grandmother is wearing in my favorite photo of her.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. 2013 was a banner year for the world's stock markets. Many portfolios saw a gain of 25% or more. The real estate market has seen some upswing as well, although perhaps the gains in most places weren't quite so heady. But overall, it's been a far cry from 5 years ago at the depths of the recession. But in Milwaukee, not all real estate has gained value. The number of vacant structures in the city is estimated at around 4,000, with more than 1,000 distressed homes on the books as well. The cost of empty, often vandalized properties is great, both in terms of loss of tax revenue for the city and on the morale, economic stability, and safety of the people living in those neighborhoods. Ruins of the City, How the Foreclosure Crisis is Harming Our Most Vulnerable Neighborhoods is the cover story of this month's Milwaukee Magazine, and its authors, Associate Editor Matt Rohde and Staff Photographer Adam Ryan Morris, are in the studio with me now. Gentlemen, welcome to Lake Effect.
Hey, glad to be here.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Let's start right with those numbers. 4,000 vacant structures in the city alone, plus another 1,000 distressed homes. Is this typical for a city the size of Milwaukee?
We're certainly not the only city that's dealing with a huge, just backbreaking volume of vacant houses. Detroit has something like 10 times as many as we do. I just saw a documentary about the Detroit Fire Department just responding to arson call after arson call, and their fire chief got to the point of, we're not even going to try to fight fires in abandoned houses anymore if we know it's abandoned, which was somewhat controversial. So it's for a city in the Midwest, a city that used to depend to a large degree on manufacturing, it's not entirely. I mean, this is pretty par for the course.
So that's really kind of frightening that this is not considered abnormal.
Right. It's sort of a national it's a national issue without being much of a national issue. It's been dealt with by states at the state level for the most part. I mean, every 6 months or so, Tom Barrett is asking Scott Walker for more money. And last time he came up with a couple billion, and before, he's kind of made it an issue. So it's pretty endemic across the country.
When you went out on this particular fact-finding mission for the story, what were you finding? Are these properties like forever condemned? Are people in the city trying to recapture them? Is the city trying to tear them down? What's going on?
Well, the city puts a premium on, they don't want to demolish these. They want to rehab as many as possible. And
now we're talking about the distressed homes.
The distressed homes,
okay.
Correct. And I guess the goal is to rehab these and save what's there, not end up with lot upon lot of grass, where structures used to be, where people used to live.
So how are they doing that? Are they providing money? What can people do if they want to get a house and rehab it?
There are a number of loan programs. Some of them are administered by WIDA. Some are administered by the city. And sometimes people that live in these homes may have problems with credit. They can't get a loan. I mean, it's hard enough to get a mortgage these days. Banks aren't terribly interested in lending you $20,000 to renovate
fix
your
roof.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Or whatever.
Exactly.
Well, and Adam, I have to say, you know, some of the photographs, they're pretty, pretty stark. It's a bleak picture. I made a note to myself that said even someone with deep pockets and a love of HGTV would be hard-pressed to see the diamonds amidst a lot of this rough.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. And there are plenty of houses that we went into that were clearly beyond repair. But there were plenty of others where there may be just this amazing mess, you know, leftover objects from whoever lived there before, evidence of squatting, that sort of thing. But when you really stop and get past that and look around at the bones of the structure, the bones of the house, you see how, okay, this could be fixed up. It'd take a lot to clear this out, a lot to clean it up, but the structure is there. It's good. It just needs some love and some repair.
But what about, you know, people, like you say, if there isn't money, if there aren't jobs, if they're not able to get a loan beyond maybe the initial city loan, you know, what's the likelihood of these properties actually being rehabbed and then inhabited and paying taxes, you know, and adding to the tax rolls of the city?
A lot of them are going to end up being demolished. It's been we're sort of in this is the second wave of the housing crisis. And it's lagged 3-4, almost 5 years behind the first wave, which was the foreclosure crisis that everyone knows about, that started to unfold around 2007, 2008. It's about roughly 3 years before the city will take a house or another property for back taxes. And in that time, often the house has been abandoned and it's may have been exposed to the elements. And it may have been broken into a dozen times and had copper plumbing ripped out, the furnace in the basement even. So we're kind of getting this backlog that's cycling through now, and it's in pretty rough shape. Estimates I got was that early next year we would be peaking. That 1,000 houses is those that are owned by the city right now. There are other ones out there that are still owned by the original owner, are still owned by banks, and kind of in limbo.
And so the city hasn't taken over those yet, so the ranks may swell.
Right. The best estimate I got was that early next year they would reach their peak of city-owned homes, and things would kind of start to subside from there. But it's quite – yeah, it's pretty intractable. Other cities have been more aggressive in demolishing. Detroit is the big example.
And, why haven't we, though, then, if that seems to be the answer? Did you get any, as you were talking to people for this story, did you get any response to that? It's like, you know, why hasn't the city been a little more aggressive in taking control of this?
I kind of got the impression there wasn't a whole lot to gain by, compared to other cities, we have it bad, but it's not quite so nightmarish. It's not quite so post-apocalyptic here. And the city isn't marketing vacant lots, you know, terribly aggressively. The city has kind of gotten burned in the past, I think, on especially after the foreclosure crisis of getting, you know, we'll sell to whoever wants to buy, and then a lot of times those are the same houses that are getting
repossessed
back
again.
Right,
yeah. So
again,
it's the same inventory over and over. And I have to think the tax implications to the city and to everyone who actually is, you know, paying their mortgage and their property taxes, I have to just imagine what our ledger sheet would look like if all of these buildings or even half of these buildings were occupied and paying taxes.
I'm not sure. We'd certainly be paying less. I mean, they suck up fire protection, and police are there. Department of Neighborhood Services is checking up on things. Department of City Development is trying to maybe just possibly sell them. Department of Public Works is pay a contractor to come and board up the windows and the doors. And
one of the figures that you quoted in the article was that there's about 300 that are slated for demolition in 2014 at about $10,000 a demolition. That's $3 million right there that we wouldn't be spending if we didn't have this.
Right, right. That's something that would go a long ways toward, you know, local street repair and
and other infrastructure
right,
needs,
right.
Yeah, of which there are many. Adam, Why the photographs? Why make this sort of a picture essay as opposed to just numbers and words?
Sure. I think When you drive around certain parts of the city, you see just green board after green board, kind of the hallmark, the trademark of these houses that the city's repossessed. From the outside, you see broken siding, some damage and whatnot, but it's really startling when you get into some of these to see the signs of the lives that were lived there. You can see a broken fence outside, a gate, maybe a garage out back, but when you get in there, you see people who left behind the food that was in their cupboards the day they were kicked out of their house. You see copies of magazines, correspondence, bills, all sorts of stuff, personal effects that were just left behind, hair dryers, kids' jackets, teddy bears. It's startling to go into these places and really see all these signs of human life. And I think it's easy to skip over those when you're just driving past, driving down the street on your way to somewhere else, and there's another house that's boarded up. There's another house that's boarded up. It's easy to forget that people lived there, that this is something it not only has implications, you know, as far as taxes and city land and whatnot, but people have been removed from their homes. People are no longer living there. It's very much a human crisis as well as a housing crisis.
I was going to say the human cost mm-hmm. is huge.
Absolutely.
Huge. Yes. And like I said, seeing those pictures, I mean, it's very, very bleak. And you feel like this is my neighborhood. This is my city.
Right. I mean, you look at some of those and you see a kitchen that could very easily, you can imagine family meals happening there, cooking and whatnot. And then you see the state that it's in now. It's been exposed to the elements for the better part of a year and the floors are bowing up and just no longer livable.
When you were putting this article together, did you have an ultimate goal in mind? Did you just want to report on what was out there, or did you want to see some particular action being taken by anyone, developers, the city, you know, possible homeowners, all?
It was mostly to document what was happening and to see what, you know, progress had been made and what people were doing. And we don't always want to do a story and just be like, see how horrible this is, and then have nothing on what's sort of already in motion. What we found that was in motion was pretty proactive. I mean, WIDA is partnering with PNC Bank to set up a program where they would buy distressed loans and stop them from getting into foreclosure in the first place and refinance. And it seems like people have gotten pretty strategic with the city, with Common Ground, and they've kind of, to a certain degree, have moved away from some of the hardest hit areas or doing triage to a degree. Everybody said, we're only a small part of the solution. You know, we're 2% of the solution. And when we added all those up, it was still pretty far from 100%.
Right. It seems like it comes back to employment opportunities, not just the ability of people to, you know, to have good homes to live in, but to be able to afford to pay for them, which it seems like in a lot of these neighborhoods, that's an issue.
Right. You can't do much. And that's what Wyman Winston, the head of WIDA, was saying, was that, you know, we've had decade after decade of declining income in the inner city. You know, people are not going to be able to renovate these homes. There are a number of real estate companies. Axe Housing is always gets cited, and Gorman and Company, who are known for doing some of the big condo projects down in Walker's Point and the Fifth Ward and that sort of thing. And they've had some success. These are also high crime areas, so it's kind of hard to get people from other areas to come in and want to buy a house there
and renovate and become a target, or at least feel that they're going to become
right.
a target. Yeah. Whether they actually are or not. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's like this vicious cycle. I wish I could look at this on the, you know, the second day of the new year and say, wow, we actually have something great and positive going forward. But it seems like steps are still very incremental. Did you find that?
Yeah. There's a story in the good old Journal Sentinel about State Rep. Evan Goyke, a Democrat from the city, who's introducing a bundle of legislation. And one of the measures would be that if you were filing a foreclosure, if you were a bank, you would have to put down a $15,000 deposit in case the house had to be demolished. that would cover the cost of the demolition.
Wow.
Is one possibility. Also, a tax break for realtors on commission on houses in foreclosures, they wouldn't have to report the commission they got from the either working for the seller or the buyer on their state income tax.
How likely are any of these to pass?
I'm not sure. This has gotten to be a pretty easy bipartisan issue. Even Walker and Barrett are getting along on those terms lately. So,
well, there's some positive news for the new year.
Yeah, there you go.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Indeed. Well, Matt and Adam, I want to thank you both very much for coming in today.
Well, thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Matt Rohde is an associate editor at Milwaukee Magazine. Adam Ryan Morris is a staff photographer for the magazine. Their article, Ruins of the City, How the Foreclosure Crisis is Harming Our Most Vulnerable Neighborhoods, is the cover story of the current issue. There's a link to it from WUWM.com/lake effect, and you can also see a couple of the photographs there from the story as well. Coming up next, a Milwaukee scientist talks about the rapid pace of change in decoding the human genome. We'll chat with Dr. Liz Worthy when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Genomic researchers at Children's Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin made news in 2010 when they successfully used genome sequencing to diagnose and treat a child with a rare medical condition. In the 3 years since, genome research hasn't slowed down. A study by another Milwaukee researcher has identified genes related to a complex speech disorder that affects children. But her work has broader implications that could lead to greater understanding of many more issues involving the human genome. Dr. Liz Worthy is an assistant professor of pediatrics at the Medical College and director of genomic informatics for the Genome Medicine Clinic at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin and the Medical College. She spoke to Mitch Teich in November and explained what her research set out to determine.
There's been a lot of movement into genomic medicine in a variety of areas, most of them related to diseases that are believed to be Mendelian in nature, meaning that there is a single gene defect that's controlled them. And what we wanted to do, or my particular interest, was something a little bit more complex. So moving more into complex genetics where multiple genes are believed to be having an effect. And we wanted to see whether we could really take this technology that's been used in a fairly small number of different types of diseases and push it into something a little bit new and different.
Well, and so apraxia was one of these conditions that was initially believed to be linked to a single mutation?
It was originally, but then people who worked in the field believed it was more heterogeneous. What they had done is they found an initial gene that was associated with it, and then they started checking people with apraxia, and they found that a very small percentage of individuals had a defect in that gene. And so the belief was that there was other genes that were being involved. And there was also a question about whether it was a single gene or not.
And so the research bore this out?
It did. So what we did, we ended up doing whole exome sequencing of a number of children, we being myself and Larry Schreiberg, and he's really the expert in apraxia.
And remind us the difference. What's the significance of the concept of an exome?
So with exome sequencing, you're sequencing about 1.2% of the whole genome, and you're focused on the part of the genome that is encodes for proteins. So it's a far cheaper approach. It costs maybe a third of the price, and you get less data, but you do get most of the pieces that are currently known to be associated with disease. And so it was actually ARRA funding that Larry had got to do this sequencing. And the amount of funding that he got meant that we did exome and not whole genome. We did it in 10 patients, and we found that a number of different genes that were involved, some which had been previously related to the disease, but also some novel ones. And perhaps most interestingly, we found that in some of the patients, they had defects in more than one gene. The defects were perhaps milder than those which cause some other monogenic diseases, but it was kind of an accumulation of smaller changes that gave rise to the disease.
On one level, it sounds like a positive development that we know more. But does the more complex cause mean that finding treatments is necessarily going to be that much more challenging because you are dealing with more than one gene here?
Not necessarily. So a treatment is normally not for a specific gene. A treatment is normally for a particular pathway within a cell, so the interacting set of genes. And so what we actually found is a number of those genes were part of the same pathway. And it's the pathway going wrong that you treat with the drug. And in actual fact, above and beyond that, finding more genes increases our knowledge about how broad and diverse that pathway is, and it may even get us into other pathways that already have drugs for them that can be then used in these cases potentially.
Well, and so using apraxia as an example, is this knowledge that you have gained through this likely to have a fairly fast impact on how someone at the treatment level might work to help a patient?
So there's two parts to that. So in terms of the development of a drug, I don't think it will be particularly fast. And the reason I don't is because we're talking about neurons and fine, small changes. And having a drug that you could use to make that alteration without affecting another part of that network would be fairly difficult. But hopeful in down the road. Surely, if we don't understand it at all, we're not going to get a treatment. But if we do understand it a little now, then we can start working towards that. But the other part of it is really being able to work out that these children early on have this type of speech problem and not some other type, so something more to do with the muscles. And with the correct diagnosis, then they can go down the correct care plan path. So I think that's very important.
So this is as much about ruling out other causes as it is about figuring out what to do about this particular cause.
Absolutely.
For people who aren't genome scientists, and there may be one or two of them listening, is the rapid pace of development at this stage related more to more powerful computing abilities or better software programming or some other technological leap or all of the above?
Both on the sequencing side and on the computational side. The real change that happened over the last few years has been the sequencing technology. But if we had only had that and not the rapid development on the computational side, we wouldn't have been able to do anything with the data. And now we're at a point where, to some extent, the sequencing is easy. And it's all computational. All of the challenges are computational.
I feel like I've used this metaphor in a previous interview with someone. Originally, I think there was the issue of, you know, essentially drinking from the fire hose. There was so much data. And so do I get from what you're saying that it no longer is drinking from the fire hose?
So I think – so to use that same analogy, we now have a filter that we can put on the fire hose to get the data out of it that we can use just now to make diagnosis and understand what's going on. However, at the same time, the rest of the data that's still in the fire hose is data that we need if we are to be able to treat everyone who has any type of disease. So we need to work out how to open it back up a little bit so that we can use that data.
Well, and talk more about that other data, because you were saying that, you know, one of the beauties of exome sequencing is that you're looking at, you know, just over 1% of the whole genome, and it's protein related, and this is where most of the disease information is. What's in the rest of the genome?
All the rest of the interesting stuff. So for me, I'm a genome person. I think the genome is the way to go. The reason that most of the variants that have been associated with disease are in the exome is because that's the only place we've looked so far. We tended to be very gene-centric. But clearly, there's lots of missing heredity in all of these disorders that have a genetic component, and it's going to be in the part that's not in the exome. Things that used to be called junk a long time ago, then turned out to be what caused Fragile X syndrome and many of these other disorders. So for me, we have to do whole genome so we can learn.
Are there things that we don't even know that we don't know yet?
Always. I think that's why we do what we do. So really, we're entering a phase now with genomics where we're starting to come back to hypothesis-driven research using genomic data. So we're starting to realize some of the things that we don't know that we want to do, and we're starting to ask those questions. But now, because we've got data, we can come back and answer those questions and come up with the next questions.
How long have you been in this field?
15 years.
Well, what is your feeling about how much of the promise of genome research is being realized today, especially compared to where it was when you were getting into the field? It seems like 15 years is almost a lifetime in this area.
So when I started my PhD, was really when genomics data was starting to be made available. And it took me 3 years to do what would take me a week or less now. I think we now have 50 or 60 new causal associations with disease coming every month, which is completely different from even where it was back in 2005, where we had 80 a year. So we're right at that inflection point. We now have the ability to have enough data. We've got the computational hardware to analyze it. All of that background over the last 10 years, it's right now. Right now is when we take off, and we already are starting to take off.
But the people who are in this for the devising treatments really have their work cut out for them with this much more information to deal with.
Well, that's going to be the next challenge. We're already seeing a furore of papers coming out around functional studies around what we find in individuals' genomes associated with their disease. Pharma are starting to be really interested in this for a variety of reasons. So it's the application of the knowledge. Applied science used to be a dirty word. We're all meant to do theoretical, but now the application is what we all need to work on.
Liz Worthy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Liz Worthy is Director of Genome Informatics for the Genome Medicine Clinic at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin and the Medical College of Wisconsin. She's also Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at the Medical College. Her findings on genetic defects in childhood apraxia were published in the Journal of Neurodevelopmental Disorders, and there's a link to her paper from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Her interview with Mitch Tite first aired in November. Coming up next, we'll have one more look back at the year that was with Wisconsin foodie Kyle Cherrick. We'll chat with him when Lake Effect returns in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. Welcome back to Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have you with us. Kyle Cherrick, our resident foodie, joins us for an end-of-the-year roundup. And, you know, it's the time of year when a lot of us are making resolutions and are thinking, well, we're going to change things. And you have quite an interesting list that you hope that the food community here will change.
I have a list. Instead of resolutions, I'd like some things to be struck from the record, essentially,
okay,
as far as food trends for the nation and for our local Milwaukee scene.
Okay, Kyle, I kind of have to take a little bit of exception to the first one because I'm very, very fond of them. Cupcakes? Really?
Cupcakes.
What's wrong with cupcakes?
Bonnie, they inspire this form of solipsism and self-absorption by way of dessert, which, come on, it's already a decadent indulgence, right? I mean, it's this ridiculous outcropping of the Burger King you can have it your way. You know, we're already turning our kids into little rock stars with ridiculous riders that say, you know, no green M&Ms. There's something healthy and decent about sharing a cake. You know, what's wrong with a cake? I get it. There are allergies. There are things like that. You know,
I'm thinking more of portion control. It's like I can have one cupcake and feel very, very decadent.
Whatever. We're coddling ourselves as Americans. If you overeat, it's your own damn fault. I support Bloomberg and everything, but let the people drink their soda to a certain extent. And it seemed to me as if there was a national tax subsidy for cupcake shops in the last 2-3 years.
That is true.
You know, and then what happens is there's so much. It's kind of like what happened with coffee when that exploded. We didn't get better coffee everywhere. We just got a lot more of it, and it sort of went down.
So are you objecting to cupcakes all the time or just having so many of them?
Oh, they're just annoying. They're like, it's like a plague of locusts at birthday parties and desserts and weddings. And it's yeah.
So as far as you're concerned, we can just ixnay the cupcakes.
In few small, I mean, it should be like a shot of Schlivovitz. You know, at the right moment, it's perfect. But just let's stick with cake.
Another thing that seems to be very, very, very popular that you're being contrarian about, mm-hmm, here, Kraft cocktails. Now, what is wrong with Kraft cocktails?
I have no problem with Kraft cocktails. I think the tradition is great. I think how they've elevated cocktailing in general. I think that bartenders are being taken more seriously. I support all of that.
But
what I don't support is menus whose font is so small and that, you know, they list out 19 ingredients to make the drink, and then the drink name is so effusively opaque that I have no idea what the drink is going to taste like. The whole endeavor just wants me to do a shot and get out of there, which is not the point of what these things should do. And by the way, you shouldn't have to pull out your phone, switch on the light, just so you can see what you're thinking of ordering. I mean, there's—
So it sounds like you're objecting more to just the detail of it.
Yeah. The trend that has happened is that craft cocktail maker after craft cocktail is trying to outdo each other. We saw this happen in the 40s with cheese when farmers started putting a little orange in, and before you know it, you had day glow colors, you know, 20 miles down the road. So I was at a bar the other night, great new place. We looked at the menu. I could not read it because the font was so small. The names made no sense to me whatsoever. And this is essentially folks within a trend trying to show off and differentiate, trying to outbeat the chest of the next cocktail maker.
So your answer would be keep it simple?
Keep it simple. Yeah. I mean, the Boulevardier. It's a great cocktail. It's an old cocktail. It's named after a real guy. If you're going to do a riff on that, which I completely encourage, and you've got the chops to do it, I mean, if you're going to mix up the steps of Fred Astaire, go for it. But don't give me a five-word title with 19 ingredients. Either the drink is good or not. I don't care, you know, how many words you can look up.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So you hate cupcakes. You're not fond of really lengthy titled craft cocktails. What about farm to table? I mean, you're the farm to table guy.
Right. I adore farm to table, but these pronouncements on menus are ridiculous. Again, if I go into another restaurant that is hanging their hat on farm to table and listing every farm and the farmer and parsing out all the ingredients, and here's the thing, farm to table, where else does the food come from, right? Duh. It's good that it does come from a farm where you have a relationship. But say that in a tiny little paragraph on the top. These restaurants that are, I think, in many ways disingenuous, where they have to spell out absolutely everything, two things occur. I know immediately from the scale of the restaurant that they're not getting that ingredient from just that farm because that's impossible. You know, they might do it for the special, but once they get through 10 specials, they're out of that ingredient. So let's be honest here. Secondly, it kind of reminds me of folks in the community that give a lot of money to a charitable cause to see their name on the building, not so much because they care about the cause. If you're using that as a marketing ploy for your menu and your food, you should probably rethink your cooking. Let's use more farms. That's great. But we don't have to shout. We don't have to bandstand.
So it's not that it's bad. It's just you don't necessarily want to know the name of the pig where your chop right. came from.
Right. Right. I mean, there's that great Portlandia that lampoons the whole, you know, going and meeting the chicken and things like that. And I adore that episode because I guess my point is there's a lot of disingenuousness going on with craft cocktails and with farm to table. Let's just be genuine. Let's say we get great ingredients. We cook really well. We hope you'll come back. And that's all.
The end.
Yeah.
Well, but it's not quite the end because speaking of the name of the pig your chop came from, the last thing on the list of things that you'd like to see go away this year, pork-centric gastropub fare.
Yes.
Now, I have to say, I am a huge porkaholic.
Mm-hmm.
You could put bacon on anything and I would be happy.
You and me both.
What's wrong with pork-centric fare?
Well, pork-centric fare is fine. The pig was a derisive animal for the longest time in American farming, and it's been raised to the level that it should be, and it's being cherished, and it tastes delicious as a result of that. I'm all for that.
Okay.
But this swing of every third restaurant opening up and having half or two-thirds of the menu being pork-centric because they photocopied or scanned or because they checked the website of somebody else's restaurant and said, yeah, we'll sell a lot with that, is just— it's ridiculous. And this gastropub thing, this is a true tradition.
Which is what? Step back just to say, well, and say what it is for people who might not know.
Yeah. So the gastropub tradition came out of England, basically, when the aristocracy fell apart, the better upper class after World War I, and everybody's private chef had to go out and essentially started their own restaurant, which really was the public houses that Queen Elizabeth had set up, the pubs, right? So you've got these amazing classically trained chefs. They know ingredients and budget was never an issue previously. And they move into pubs that have one cook stove in the corner and nearby ingredients that they could reconnoiter from farmers. That fare became so delicious. and engaging and hearty and substantive that it became its own discipline. Embrace that. Great. If you can do that, I mean, I want to eat there every night, and sometimes I do. But the trending of restaurants that open under that moniker, I'm pretty sure were Dante alive and eating in America right now, he'd have a special circle in hell reserved for those restaurateurs.
And all of that pork-centric food.
Well,
just because it's pork.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't make it special. You know, you've got to do something with it and not just what you saw on someone else's menu.
It sounds like in all of these four cases that you've listed that what you're asking chefs and restaurant owners to do is dare to be themselves and
Absolutely.
Not try to just jump on a bandwagon.
Yeah. I mean, in every craft or discipline, whether it's music or art or anything, which is what these chefs are attempting, there's that delicate line. You go too far and the audience isn't ready. You stay behind too far and you've relegated yourself to you know.
Has been.
Yeah, exactly. And there are a lot of people in the restaurant cuisine world that just want to make a lot of money. I guess that's okay. But you're dealing with living things that then your chefs are alchemizing into something very special. It's one of the most intimate experiences we can have, having a meal. I mean, it's profound. You're putting something in your body. So if you're working within a tradition, respect that tradition. Don't just fill a menu up with the latest and the greatest and what you consider the grooviest, because as they say in Hollywood, that doesn't always walk.
Now, to kind of wrap up on a more cheerful note, is there anything that you've been happy with this year that you're glad to see happening here in Milwaukee?
Yeah, I'm glad to see that a lot of the chefs that stayed here in larger institutions are opening up their own places, and they're doing exactly what I just complained a bunch of others aren't. They're putting their best guests, their best talents, their best ideas up against the menu and up against the public, and they're willing to either succeed or fail on that. I don't think there's anything more exciting, whether you see it in any discipline or art, when someone risks like that but also believes so firmly. And the fact that we have restaurants or restaurateurs, owners that are willing to let them do that, I mean, it gives me goosebumps. This is really fantastic for the city. And those are the kind of places that when people who aren't from here come through for 2 or 3 days or a week or whatever, those are the ones that wow them. Those are the ones that they remember.
Just don't put a cupcake on the menu.
So, you know what? I know after this segment airs, I'm going to sit down in one of these restaurants and the chef is going to send out like a pork slider with a cupcake and a 19-ingredient craft cocktail.
Or maybe 20 just to do it. Well, Kyle, thanks so much for a wonderful year of conversation, and I look forward to 2014.
I love coming. Thanks for having me.
Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherik is host and producer of the public television show Wisconsin Foodie. He also writes a regular column for Milwaukee Magazine's website. We'll take one last break and then a glimpse inside early 20th century Shanghai life with writer Amy Tan. That's coming up when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. The issue of human trafficking has been a significant one in the past year. Between human rights abuses in places such as Sudan, to global prostitution and internet pornography rings. A sting operation earlier in 2013 saved 10 victims of human trafficking right here in Wisconsin. Writer Amy Tan's latest novel plays out in a different place and in an earlier era, one in which the sex industry was somewhat more in the open, if not any less insidious. The Valley of Amazement takes place mainly in China early in the 20th century, and it tells the story of one family's role in the world of the courtesan. It examines mother-daughter relationships, betrayal and loss, and with a helping of dark humor. Amy Tan joined Mitch Tyke in the studio recently to share her first novel in a decade, and she began by explaining the significance that courtesans had during the period in which most of the book takes place.
The courtesans of Shanghai started around in the 1850s when this Shanghai was getting started. They are different levels. If you look at the continuum of the sex trade, there were first-class courtesans, second-class, maybe flower opium houses,
people, women who took in people in their own homes, and then also streetwalkers, and then down to the sex slaves who were in the sheds. So it was about one out of every 100 women in Shanghai at one period were in the sex trade. Courtesans, one of the key differences also is that they were courted. They had many suitors who came, and the woman got to choose who would have their favors in the boudoir.
And in the case of a so-called first-class courtesan house, this was a fairly elite clientele.
They would be the top officials, the business people who would come, people who were doing foreign trade, which is a huge thing that was going on in Shanghai during that early 20th century. And I imagine they were privy to the secrets that people were talking about.
Well, and the house where much of the formative moments, many of the formative moments of the story is set, the Hidden Jade Path or the House of Lulu Mimi, mm-hmm. is at the nexus of Shanghai and Western influences. Was that emblematic of courtesan culture, at least at the first class level?
What I found out is that they were very influential in bringing Western culture into Shanghai, making at least furniture, food and things like that acceptable. And I could only imagine that they would possibly help bridge the gap in other ways in business. The actual house that allowed Western men to come in and be there in a sort of social club, and Chinese men coming in for the first-class courtesan house atmosphere, that was made up. I made that up with bridging the two cultures, because usually Chinese people and Western people didn't do anything socially together. Business, yes. Social, no.
And you set this in what was known as the international settlements,
yeah.
Which I don't know that many people are aware of. This was a part of Shanghai where Westerners lived essentially as Westerners among Westerners.
Yeah, it was like its own separate enclave, its own country. It operated by its own laws, its own police, the British police, American laws. And they were basically insulated throughout the beginning of the war until, for the U.S., December 7th, 1941, then they became part of Japanese territory. Otherwise, they were immune. And the courtesan houses were located in the international settlement. I didn't know it until recently that our family home was located there as well. So Chinese people lived there, but it was mostly set up for the foreigners.
And you mentioned your family home. If I'm not mistaken, the spark that set you on the road to writing this novel was a photograph you saw at a gallery that reminded you of one that you had seen many, many times.
I found it actually in a book after going to an Asian art museum exhibit on Shanghai. And I turned the page. I was looking. I thought it was so interesting. The women were so influential and powerful. And I turned the page and I saw 10 beauties of Shanghai, these 10 young women, five of them wearing an outfit identical to the outfit my grandmother is wearing in my favorite photo of her that I looked at every day as I wrote for inspiration.
And at the time before then, you had no idea the significance of the outfit she wore.
I just thought it was a beautiful outfit. And this outfit was specific to courtesans. I read on. I thought, well, maybe it was a popular fashion. But it was a headband that came to a V at the top of the forehead, a tight jacket, collar went to just below the earlobe, tight sleeves, lining showing, very specific, and the most interesting, taken in a Western photo studio with pots of flowers around it. And I talked to three academics, and it was the Western photo studio that was the most significant.
And that's because typically there was no reason for a Chinese woman to be in a Western photo studio?
It just wasn't proper. The only women who went there were courtesans. The furniture was Western. They did poses that were not traditional. And the contrast to me, the effect of looking at this had a lot to do with the family stories about my grandmother, that she was old-fashioned, traditional, quiet. And the one thing I got out of this was she was not old-fashioned. Whether she was a courtesan, I would never be able to say for sure unless I saw a written document that she signed. It opened up a huge mystery of who this woman was. And that was the more important question, not what she did, but who she was. Not quiet, not traditional. And I found out through doing a lot more research, she had very strong opinions.
Was telling the story a way for you to fill in the gaps in your grandmother's real story, or did you simply take this element of ambiguity and then use it to craft something from whole cloth?
I did the latter, using the ambiguity, using the contradictions in the family stories, because I find that contradictions and ambiguity are the place where stories begin. I decided I would craft a completely different story. But what's similar is that these are women who found themselves thrown into a different situation. Suddenly their circumstances are changed, their lives upturned, and how would they have to remake themselves? What parts of them would always remain the same? What is their character? Who are they? That is the question I have of my grandmother. It is not her narrative. It is not about whether she really was a courtesan. So there are courtesans, and they are different people.
Well, and certainly to put someone in the position of a woman in that era, in that place, needing to remake herself, there were not a lot of options.
No, you couldn't. What happened to a lot of these courtesans, some of them came from very well-to-do families, and the families lost all their wealth. What could they do? Lost the husband, had no support. Or they were kidnapped, girls who were kidnapped. Or, you know, their mothers had always been courtesans. But you couldn't just leave the courtesan house, go to school, and get a job as a teacher. You had to be born into a certain class, have a very modern family who decided to educate you. Or you were born into a servant class. I don't think people always understand that. You don't, in certain cultures and times, you didn't have a choice.
And certainly for Violet, who is the central character in most of the story, she is part American and part Chinese, which puts her in an even less advantageous position in Shanghai at this time.
Yeah. Mixed race girls, as they sometimes call them, or Eurasians, were looked down on both sides, you know, tainted in two ways. And a lot of them ended up in orphanages, never got adopted, never could marry. Learned how to weave by the missionaries. So Violet was in a tenuous situation and somehow makes her way into the world, finding her place as a courtesan.
How much contemporary writing exists from that time about how these houses worked?
There is one particular book that I used. It was by a journalist in 1893 who visited courtesan houses every night. And he wrote fiction, but it was really based on his experiences. And that, to me, was the window into what really happened. The real life, the grievances, the competition, the jealousies, the men who were unfaithful and going off with other courtesans, the gifts that were required, that sort of thing. There were other books that had been written in the 1800s. So that's what I depended on, the fiction that was written.
There's a section of the book where you go into great detail about the hypothetical storytelling techniques a courtesan might use to seduce a patron, which is both hilarious and more than a little horrifying. And I'm curious whether it is entirely your imagination or whether it was inspired by some contemporary writing.
That was my imagination. But there is a story. It's a real story. Peach Blossom Spring.
Right.
Everybody knows that story. If you're Chinese and a kid, you grow up with it. And I just imagine the different ways you could tell that story, eroticize it a little. And that was probably a profane, you know, sacrilegious, tell this famous story as a seduction piece.
Although it is interesting, it leads one to start thinking about any number of Western fairy tales in the same way.
Yeah. I am sure Little Red Riding Hood could be turned into something like that.
On a more serious level, do you see a difference between the courtesan culture that existed at the turn of the last century in its time and place and the issues of sexual slavery and human trafficking that exist today?
Sex slavery is a huge problem. I'd say it's one of the top five, at least top 10 in the world. And in the United States, people think it's only in other countries. Sex slavery existed back then. Of course, little girls were kidnapped, or uncles or brothers would sell these girls. It was huge. So courtesans, actually, if they were kidnapped and became courtesans, they were quite lucky. They were courtesans who had freedoms after a while. They could get up when they wanted, design their own clothes, go out in public, ride in carriages, create themselves as seductresses and become businesswomen, negotiators. Whereas sex slaves, these little girls, 9 years old, they had to turn maybe 20 tricks a day. Horrible life. Died young.
Was there inspiration for you for the painting from which this book takes its name?
I was in Berlin and doing a quick tour of the National Gallery, and I came across this painting called The Valley of Amazement. And it was so – it was that ambiguity we talked about where it was – it looked like a storm was coming or leaving. It looked like it was dawn or dusk. It was at once forbidding and maybe hopeful, and I was trying to decide, did the painter intend one or the other? Were we leaving or arriving? And I thought it was such a wonderful metaphor later that I wanted to use it as the title of the book because it captured what I found happens to all of us. We're at a crossroads. We have to see something. What are we really seeing? And we have to decide and go forward or leave. I saw another painting that was very much like that by Albert Bierstadt, who's an American painter, the Hudson River Valley School of Painting in the 1800s. And it was very similar, a storm, valley, dawn or dusk. That one looked more hopeful. So he was an artist that I put in there. Unfortunately, I didn't note the name of the German artist. I'm sure the people in Germany, once it's translated, of course, it was Carl Blecken. How could you not know?
I'm curious. There is much that is unpleasant that plays out in the nearly 600 pages that make up the book. You know, there's rape and violence and betrayal. How do you, as a writer, when you're immersed in your work, how do you compartmentalize and be able to maintain this overall picture of yourself and where the book is going and also channel the difficult stuff that's coming out of your pen or your fingers?
Well, for one thing, I do have a character who's a little bit more humorous, Magic Gord, who's a sidekick who's very much like my mother in her voice. But all of those things that you talked about, the abandonment, rape, suicide, all of that was part of our family history. And I put it in there because it's meaningful to me. I also didn't want to glorify the sex trade. That would be very, very wrong. And here's the reality of what it is. Yes, they had a glamorous life, but here's what they're facing in the future. The life of the courtesan lasted very briefly from the age of, say, 14 or 15 until the early 20s. So I take these very bad situations, and I try to keep in mind with respect this was the life of women back then. And it's really to honor them for what they went through and for giving us, their descendants, a kind of strength that was passed on from one woman to her daughter to her granddaughter. And that's in me.
Amy Tan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Amy Tan's latest novel is called The Valley of Amazement. It was recently included on the New York Times list of 100 notable books for 2013. Amy Tan was in Milwaukee recently for an event at El Verno College and to visit her sister, who lives just west of town. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. I hope you're with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10. For Lake Effect, from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned now. Fresh air comes your way next.